Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. Today, we take a look back at the character of our time with part one of a stunning speech by Chris Hedges. I hope you'll stay tuned. Another year is over. Once again, I will spare you a review of the past year's top news stories. Everything this year was just too bizarre and depressing and intolerable for words. Among journalists, only the late Hunter S. Thompson could have done the year justice. Have you read Hunter S. Thompson? 1972 was a year almost as bad as 2014. Not in every way, but for sure in its politics. Thompson captured the spirit of that year brilliantly in his book Fear and Loathing on the Campaign Trail. He also wrote Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas, another fine work. Alas, he's not with us this year to write Fear and Loathing in the Belly of the Superpower. Hunter Thompson could have captured the essence of 2014 in words. I myself am drawing a blank, except for two words about the past year. Good riddance. I never cared for Bill Cosby anyway, let alone Dick Cheney. But I think we need some reflection on the character of our time, and for that we turn once again to journalist and essayist Chris Hedges. This summer, somebody posted a video of a Hedges speech on YouTube. There was no indication of the date or title of the original speech, but the video was named Chris Hedges' Greatest Speech Ever Made. I assume that the person who posted the video is young, because the title he gave it is entirely devoid of punctuation. Chris Hedges' Greatest Speech Ever Made. So I don't know if this is the greatest speech by anybody ever made, or just the greatest speech Chris Hedges ever made. Actually, it's neither, but it does strike me as a pretty good speech. Personally, I think the Sermon on the Mount was a better speech than this one, but I'll grant that this speech by Hedges is better than Lincoln's Gettysburg Address, and much better than Richard Nixon's famous Checkers speech. Though I did like Nixon's line about Pat's good Republican cloth coat. But back to Hedges. Many people have assumed that this newly posted speech was made in 2014. But it seems to me that a more likely date is 2011. In the speech, Hedges refers to Bradley Manning, not Chelsea Manning. There's a reference to a recent royal wedding, and there's no mention of Occupy Wall Street. The speech is probably promoting Hedges' second book of 2010, The World as It Is, Dispatches on the Myth of Human Progress. But whatever the date of the speech, Hedges is also talking about today. Very little has changed. We just have 100 more examples we could add to the 50 examples Hedges gives. Examples of American freedom, democracy, and prosperity going to hell in a handbasket. We'll hear this talk this week and next. Robin Upton has nicely edited the talk for radio, and we will hear that edition. I'm going to give the speech a title myself, and that title is The Myth of Progress, The Necessity of Rebellion. Here is Chris Hedges.
I have walked through the barren remains of Babylon in Iraq, and the ancient Roman city of Antioch, the capital of Roman Syria, which now lies buried in silt deposits. I have visited the marble ruins of Leptis Magna, once one of the most important agricultural centers in the Roman Empire, and now isolated in the desolate drifts of sand southeast of Tripoli. I have climbed at dawn up the ancient temples in Tikal, while flocks of brightly colored toucans leapt through the jungle foliage below. I have stood amid the remains of the ancient Egyptian city of Luxor along the Nile, looking at the statue of the great Egyptian pharaoh Ramses II, lying broken on the ground, with Percy Shelley's poem Ozymandias running through my head. My name is Ozymandias, King of Kings. Look on my works, ye mighty, and despair. Nothing beside remains round the decay of that colossal wreck, boundless and bare. The lone and level sands stretch far away. Civilizations rise, decay, and die. Time, as the ancient Greeks argued for individuals and for states, is cyclical. As societies become more complex, they become inevitably more precarious. They become increasingly vulnerable, burdened by vast bureaucracies, an increasingly rapacious and disconnected elite, and a blind loyalty to ideological systems and ideas that no longer correspond to reality. And as they begin to break down, there is a strange retreat by a frightened and confused population from reality, an inability to confront the fragility and impending collapse. The elites who speak in phrases and jargon that do not correspond to the real retreat into isolated compounds, whether at the court of Versailles, the Forbidden City, or our own enclaves of wealth and privilege. The elites indulge within these enclaves in unchecked hedonism, the accumulation of vaster wealth and extravagant consumption. They shut themselves off from the suffering of the masses who are repressed to extract wealth upwards with greater and greater ferocity. Resources are ruthlessly and thoughtlessly depleted until they are exhausted or destroyed. And then the hollowed out edifice, which appeared unassailable and solid, collapses. The Roman and Sumerian empires fell this way. The Mayan elites, after cutting down their forests and polluting their streams with silt and acids, retreated like all dead empires back into primitivism. As food and water shortages expand across the globe, as mounting poverty and misery, including rising food costs, trigger street protests in the Middle East, Africa, and Europe, our elites are doing what all elites do. They launch more wars. They build grander monuments to themselves. They plunge their nations deeper into debt, and they take it out on the backs of the workers and the poor. The collapse of our global economy, which wiped out a staggering $40 trillion in wealth, was only the first jolt. Our elites, after destroying and dismantling our manufacturing base, sold massive quantities of fraudulent mortgage-backed securities to pension funds, small investors, banks, universities, state and foreign governments, and shareholders. And when the speculative game imploded, they looted the treasury, crying out that the nation had a deficit crisis. And of course it does not, it has a revenue crisis. And began dismantling basic social services, making war on the last vestiges of our unions, slashing jobs, freezing wages, throwing some 6 million Americans out of their homes, and standing idly by as we created a permanent underclass of unemployed and underemployed, which now sees 1 in 6 American workers without jobs. The Mayan elite became, at the end, the anthropologist Robert Wright notes in A Short History of Progress, extremists or ultra-conservatives squeezing the last drops of profit from nature and humanity. This is how all civilizations, including our own, ossify and die. The signs of imminent death may be, to those who can break free from our electronic hallucinations, undeniable. Common sense may cry out for a radical new response, But the race towards self-immolation only accelerates because of our intellectual and moral paralysis. As Sigmund Freud grasped and beyond the pleasure principle and civilization and its discontents, human societies are as intoxicated and blinded by their own headlong rush toward death and destruction as they are by the search for erotic fulfillment. We live now in a nation where doctors destroy health, lawyers destroy justice, universities destroy knowledge, government destroys freedom, the press destroys information, religion destroys morals, and our banks destroy the economy. The turmoil in the Middle East, the implosion of national economies such as those of Ireland and Greece, the collapse of states such as Somalia and Ivory Coast, the increasing anger of a beleaguered working class at home and abroad, the growing, desperate human migrations, and the refusal to halt our relentless destruction of the ecosystem on which human life depends are the harbingers of our own collapse. They are the consequences of the idiocy of our elite and the folly of globalization. Protests and movements that are not built around a complete reconfiguration of American society, including a rapid dismantling of empire and the corporate state, can at best only forestall the inevitable. We will be saved only with the birth of a new and militant radicalism, one that defies all formal power structures, including the Democratic Party, which seeks to dethrone our corporate elite from power, not negotiate for better terms. Human societies seem cursed to repeat these cycles of exploitation and collapse. The greater the extent of the deterioration, the less these societies are able to comprehend what is happening to them. And the earth is littered with the physical remains of human folly, ignorance, and hubris. There is a dark intoxication with extinction, although this moment appears to be the denouement of the whole sad show of settled, civilized life that began some 5,000 years ago. For there is nothing left this time on the planet to seize, and we are now spending down the last remnants of our natural capital, including our forests, fossil fuel, air, and water. This time, when we go down, it will be global. There will be no new lands to pillage, no new peoples to conquer and exploit. Technology, which has obliterated the constraints of time and space, has turned our global village into a global death trap. The fate of Easter Island will be writ large across the broad expanse of planet Earth. The failure of the liberal class, whose role in society is designed to prevent unchecked assault by centralized power, is discovering what happens when you tolerate the intolerant. Let hate speech pollute your airwaves. Let corporations dry up your courts and state and federal legislative bodies. Let the Christian religion be manipulated by charlatans to demonize Muslims, gays, intellectuals, discredit science, sanctify unfettered capitalism, and become a source of personal enrichment. Let unions wither under corporate assault. Let social services and public education be gutted and stripped of funding. Let Wall Street carry out fraud, deception, and plunder with impunity, and you roll out the welcome mat for fascism. The liberal class and much of the left has busied itself with the toothless pursuits of inclusiveness, multiculturalism, identity politics, and tolerance, a word Martin Luther King never used, and forgot about the primacy of justice. It naively sought to placate ideological and corporate forces bent on the destruction of the democratic state as well as the planet. The liberal class, like the misguided Democrats in the former Yugoslavia or the hapless aristocrats in the Weimar Republic, invited the wolf into the henhouse. It forgot that as Karl Popper wrote in The Open Society and its enemies, if we extend unlimited tolerance even to those who are intolerant, if we are not prepared to defend a tolerant society against the onslaught of the intolerant, then the tolerant will be destroyed and tolerance with them. Financial regulation, largely put in place by the New Deal, not only protected us from the worst excesses of capitalism, but were the bulwarks that made democratic participation possible. Workers in this country fought long and hard for their rights. They suffered brutal beatings, mass expulsions from company housing and jobs, endured crippling strikes, targeted assassinations of union leaders, and armed battles with hired gun thugs and state militias. The Rockefellers, the Mellons, the Carnegies, and the Morgans, the Koch brothers, Industries, Goldman Sachs, and Walmart of their day never gave a damn about workers. All they cared about was profit. The 8-hour workday, the minimum wage, Social Security, pensions, job safety, paid vacations, retirement benefits, and health insurance were achieved because hundreds of thousands of workers physically fought a system of capitalist exploitation. They rallied around radicals such as Mother Jones, United Mine Workers President John L. Lewis, and Big Bill Haywood and his Wobblies, as well as the socialist presidential candidate Eugene V. Debs. They had no illusion that the bosses were their friends, much less celebrities, to be admired and emulated. It is they who made possible our middle class and opened up our democracy. The elite fought back viciously. Federal marshals, state militias, sheriff's deputies, and at times army troops, along with the courts and legislative bodies, were used to crush and stymie worker revolts. Striking sugarcane workers were gunned down in Louisiana in 1887. Steel workers were shot to death in 1892 in Homestead, Pennsylvania. Railroad workers in the Pullman strike of 1894 were murdered. Coal miners at Ludlow, Colorado in 1914 and at Matewan, West Virginia in 1920 were massacred. Our freedoms and rights were paid for with the blood of ordinary men and women. American democracy arose because those consciously locked out of the system put their bodies on the line and demanded justice. The exclusion of the poor and the working class from the systems of power in this country was, after all, deliberate. The Founding Fathers deeply feared popular democracy, and they rigged the system to protect the elite from the start, something that has been largely whitewashed in public schools and by a corporate media that has effectively substituted myth for history. Europe's poor, fleeing to America from squalid slums and workhouses in the 17th and 18th centuries, were viewed by the elite as commodities to exploit. Slaves, Native Americans, indentured servants, women, and men without property were not represented at the constitutional conventions. And American history, as Howard Zinn pointed out in The People's History of the United States, has been one long fight by the marginalized and the disenfranchised for dignity and freedom. Those who fought this battle understood the innate cruelty of capitalism. When you sell your product, you retain your person, said a tract published in the 1880s during the Lowell, Massachusetts mill strikes. But when you sell your labor, you sell yourself, losing the rights of free men and becoming vassals of mammoth establishments of a moneyed aristocracy that threatens annihilation to anyone who questions their right to enslave and oppress. Those who work in the mills ought to own them, not have the status of machines ruled by private despots who are entrenching monarchic principles on democratic soil as they drive downwards freedom and rights, civilization, health, morals, and intellectuality in the new commercial feudalism. As Noam Chomsky points out, The sentiment expressed by the Lowell mill workers predated Marxism. It points to a time in American history 150 years ago when working for wages was a form of chattel slavery. The slogan of the Republican Party, the banner under which Northern workers went to fight in the Civil War, was, "We're against chattel slavery and wage slavery. Free people did not rent themselves to others. Freedom means not taking orders from others." It took a long time, Chomsky points out, to drive into people's heads the idea that it is legitimate to rent yourself. And once that was accomplished, we began to internalize oppression. We chatter about something called the American dream. And now that the oligarchic elite have regained control of all of the levers of power, that dream is being exposed as a cruel hoax. And we are being shoved back into the cage. Slick public relations campaigns. The collapse of public education. Nearly a third of the country is illiterate or semi-literate. The rise of amoral politicians such as Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, who pose as liberals while selling their souls and betraying basic liberal and democratic principles for corporate money, have left us largely defenseless. The last vestiges of unionized workers in the public sector are reduced to protesting in states like Wisconsin for collective bargaining, in short, the right to ask employers for fair working conditions. This shows how far labor and the country has deteriorated, and it looks as though even this basic right to ask, as well as raise money through union dues, has at least for the moment been successfully revoked in Madison. The Democratic Party and the remnants of organized labor steered passions in Wisconsin away from a general strike where workers should have gone to tepid attempts to recall legislators. The public debate, meanwhile, dominated by corporate control systems of information, ignores the steady impoverishment of the working class and absence of legal and regulatory mechanisms to prevent our reconfiguration into a neo-feudal society. The airwaves are saturated with good-looking and charming corporate apologists. They ask us why public sector employees have benefits sneeringly called entitlements, while non-unionized working and middle-class people are denied. And the argument is ingenious. It pits desperate worker against desperate worker in a mad scramble for scraps. It is, of course, the wrong question. Why, we should ask, don't working men and women have health insurance, pension plans, job protection, and living wages? And until we again speak in the language of open class warfare, grasping, as those who went before us did, that the elite will always promote itself at our expense, we are doomed to a 21st serfdom. The pillars of the liberal establishment, which once made incremental and piecemeal reform possible, no longer function. The liberal church, for example, forgot that Christian heretics exist. It forgot that the scum of society, look at the new Newt Gingrich, always wrap themselves in the flag and clutch the Christian cross to promote programs that mock the core teachings of Jesus Christ. And for all their years of seminary training and Bible study, these liberal clergy have stood by mutely as tele-evangelists betrayed and exploited the gospel to promote bigotry, hatred, and greed. What was the point, I wonder, of ordination? Did they think the radical message of the gospel was something they would never have to fight for? Schools and universities on their knees for corporate dollars and their boards dominated by hedge fund managers and investment bankers have deformed education into the acquisition of narrow vocational skills that serve specialized corporate interests. Our public schools create classes of drone-like systems managers. They make little attempt to equip students to make moral choices, stand up for civic virtues, to seek a life of meaning, and to actually think. The moral and ethical issues that should define education are no longer asked. Humanities departments whose liberal arts curriculum once challenged structures and assumptions are vanishing as swiftly as the ocean's fish stocks. The electronic and much of the print press has become a shameless mouthpiece for the powerful, a vehicle for spectacle and a magnet for corporate advertising. As anyone watching the live coverage of the royal wedding, sponsored by J.P. Morgan Chase, grasped. It does not give a platform to the poor, to working men and women, but diverts us with celebrity meltdowns, lavish lifestyle programs, reality television, and gossip. Artists who once had something to say have retreated into elite enclaves, preoccupied themselves with abstract, self-referential junk and the frivolous. Advertising agencies and publicists flood the airwaves with lies on behalf of corporate sponsors, and the Democratic Party, most egregiously, sold out working men and women for corporate money. It permitted, under Clinton and Obama, the state apparatus to be surrendered to corporate interests. And there is no liberal institution left. The press, labor, culture, public education, the church, or the Democratic Party that makes any effort to hold back the corporate juggernaut. And the longer we are tricked into investing our faith in the power system, the more easily we will be exploited. We have been taught to tolerate the intolerant, from propaganda outlets such as Fox News to Christian fascists to lunatics and bigots in the Republican Party, to a criminal class on Wall Street and in corporations, and we are paying the price. The only place left for us is on the street.
Chris Hedges, with a shrewd argument that our society has not been progressing. In fact, it's been regressing. While the rich and powerful have been getting richer and more powerful, the 99% have been moving further away from liberty, fraternity, equality, prosperity, and democracy. Please come back again next week for the second half of this talk. You've been listening to New World Notes. Our website is newworldnotes.blogspot.com. Thanks again to Robin Upton of unwelcomeguests.net for the lightly edited audio. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust. Thank you for listening. Illegitimate non-carborundum, and keep up the good fight. Ciao.